House Committee on General Government will now come to order, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 287.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move the rules be suspended. Oh, that's not the one, is it?
Not the one.
Gotta be able to count.
Back to that.
It's on the bottom of the sheet.
Gotta be able to count.
The bottom half.
The bottom half, not the top half.
Oh, okay, got it.
You ready for this?
Well, I think she's going to continue with this.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 287 to the floor without recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Bowman has moved Senate Bill 287 to the floor without recommendation and it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objection? All right. Motion carries. All right. Close the work session on Senate Bill 287. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 198. I believe so. Yeah. All right, Mr. Shannon, if you will come this way.
Just no respect in here for me at all.
Hi, gentlemen. Welcome. Appreciate you coming back. Let's talk a little bit about where we are with this bill. Okay? I'll let you pick any aspect that you'd like to readdress that you felt we weren't quite square on last time we talked.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Shannon. I'm a bond attorney in Portland and also the chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. And substance of 198 prior to the proposed amendment are technical amendments relating to public finance that the commission has developed through testimony from the public and local government officials. We feel they're technical amendments to assist local governments in their debt management and debt issuance process. The proposed amendments are the primarily Senate Bill, or in total, Senate Bill 199, which died on the Senate side. I have with me today David Boyer, the finance director for Multnomah County. Dave was unavailable on Monday because he was out of town, and so I thought if there was an opportunity for him to testify, that would be beneficial. The substance of the amendments, the primary one that Dave is here to address is the ability of counties to issue, as all other local governments can, what are called limited tax bonds, that is, bonds that are payable from a municipality's limited taxing authority, limited by Measures 5 and Measures 50. This was addressed back in 1991 when Measure 5 was enacted, but counties have a constitutional debt limit in the Oregon Constitution, and so they weren't allowed to issue limited tax bonds because that constitutional provision provides that the debt limit applies unless the legislature enacts a cap on this type of debt. And so what the first part of the amendments to 198 does is, in fact, create that cap of not more than 1% of the real market value of the taxable property within the county. Another concept in 199 allows a local government to establish its own procedure for the competitive sale of its bonds. We have a statutory procedure for the competitive sale of bonds. It has been amended at each session for the past three sessions because of changes in the marketplace, and we are always on the behind in trying to keep up with the marketplace. So this proposal would continue the current methodology of competitive sale, but it would also allow the governing body of a municipality to establish its own procedure. It must be done by the governing body. So that hopefully would allow some of the more sophisticated local governments to access the public market in a more efficient manner. Again, the hope and the anticipation is that it would take advantage of lower borrowing costs. Another concept would amend the advance refunding statute, which is a methodology of refinancing a debt that cannot be paid at the current time of the refinancing. When you refinance your mortgage, you get a lower interest rate on the new mortgage, you pay off the old. Public finance in the bond market has prepayment penalties in many cases or prepayment prohibitions. So what the advance refunding statute does is allows you to refinance those and then hold the proceeds of the new debt in an escrow until the old debt can be repaid under its terms. What this provision, under federal law, you can only do that once. What this provision would allow you to do is to contract with a bond purchaser to sell bonds at a future date when it would no longer be considered an advance refunding but would be considered a current refunding. So you contract today to sell bonds 2 years from now when you can then pay off the currently outstanding bonds. That will allow you to lock in lower interest rates. And finally, the fourth concept, would allow the investment of bond proceeds into what's called a guaranteed investment contract. That is where you contract with a party to pay you a specific interest rate, provided that that specific interest rate is guaranteed by that party, and secondly, that the obligation must be collateralized by United States obligations or guarantees, and that the collateral must be held by the local government or an agent for the local government, so that there is not only a guaranteed rate of return, but there is security, namely U.S. Treasuries, as security for that obligation. Those are the amendments done 199.
Thank
or
you.
198.
Any questions about the amendments? Representative Harper.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, do you say this failed in the Senate? What was that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, Senate Bill 199 was passed by the General Government Committee with a do-pass recommendation. When it was considered on the Senate floor, it was referred to the Revenue Committee for an analysis of any revenue impacts it may have, and then it was never considered again. It was so late I'm not a technician in this area, but I understood that bills had to be out of one of the chamber they were introduced by a week or so ago, and the referral to the Revenue Committee came so late they didn't have an opportunity to get it on their plate in order to get it out by the appropriate time. At least that's what I was told. I had one conversation with the revenue officer, and he was asking me about the county provision specifically, and we then tried to get it scheduled and be done.
Follow up.
Have you heard from the Senate Revenue Chair? Have you discussed this with him?
No, I have not.
You have not. Okay, I got one or two more. Okay.
Go ahead, please.
If the county defaults today, what happens under current statute? If the county defaults today, what's our current rule? And if this were in place, what would be the law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, I'm trying to think of the easy way to explain this. This applies only to...
I hope you do.
This provision applies only to non-voter-approved debt, which is subject to the limits of the Oregon Constitution, Measures 5 and Measures 50. Currently, counties have the authority to enter into lease purchase agreements for non-voter-approved debt. You notice from the testimony that I handed out, the Moody's rating letter, as well as what Mr. Boyer handed to you today, that in order to market these bonds or these obligations, namely these purchases, without a voter approval, you need to have security in the asset being purchased, namely a lien on the asset, and secondly, you need to have a reserve account approximately 10% of the principal amount of the bonds needs to be held in a reserve account, so your borrowing is 10% higher than what it would really need to be. If you were to default on that, then they would first exhaust the reserve account, and secondly, they could, like any foreclosure, go through and take back the property. If this provision is approved, the county pledges its limited taxing authority, namely its ability to impose a tax up to the Measure 5 and Measure 50 limits, their general fund, in essence. It becomes a binding obligation for the county. If the result is there would not be the necessity for a lien on the property, and secondly, they do not need the reserve account, so immediately their borrowing will go down by 10%. If they were then to default, the owner of the obligation will go to court, and a judge would order the county to make the payment. If they had to do something within their budget to find money to do it, they could do that. But under the current law, they could walk away from the obligation if they're willing to give the facility back.
So let me make sure I understand.
Follow it.
So the county taxpayers are ultimately responsible if everything else falls into crack, fails. Under this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harper, it's a binding obligation of the county.
Of the county taxpayers.
Correct. The result is, however, you get lower interest rate right. And lower initial cost.
I got you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
Are you interested in a motion?
I would certainly take a motion, sure.
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 198.
Representative Bowman moves the dash A3 amendments into Senate Bill 198. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck? Bowman?
Aye.
Decker?
Aye.
Harper?
No.
Starr? Sunseri?
No.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye.
Didn't follow our count. Have a look.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 198 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 198 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay, clerk.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck? Bowman?
Yes.
Decker?
Yes.
Harper?
No.
Starr? Sunseri?
No.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries. And Carrier, Representative Bowman, would you?
Yes, I'll carry it.
Representative Bowman.
I won't explain it, but I'll
carry
it.
Wait, I might want to carry this one.
Yeah, do the go, no.
No.
All right. Close the work session on 198. Yes. I'd like to make an announcement here, too, and that is 3502 is off our schedule, and Senate Bill 180 is off our schedule. All right. Now, two. All right, we'll now open a work session on public hearing, rather, on Senate Bill 280. Thank you. And John Booten, VCDS, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am John Booten with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here to speak today in support of our bill, Senate Bill 280. Senate Bill 280 is about financial and statistical database and the compilation and maintenance of that database. The database supports establishing the cost Oregon employers are charged for workers' compensation insurance, as well as providing cost information for legislative and administrative system management. The source of the information in this database is derived from every policy issued to cover Oregon workers. The statistics from those policies are reported by the insurance company that is providing the coverage through a licensed rating organization. That rating organization processes the data, compiles, and maintains the database. At this point, there is one licensed rating organization in the state of Oregon, the National Council on Compensation Insurance. And in the very near future, there's a very strong probability we will have two. And that brings me to the purpose of this bill. Senate Bill 280 provides for the licensing of one or more rating organizations at the discretion of the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It further creates a new entity known as a statistical agent selected from the licensed rating organizations to assist the director in the collection, compilation, and continued maintenance of this Oregon Workers' Comp database. The reason for the selection of a single statistical agent is a concern being voiced by many around the country, including the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and the American Academy of Actuaries, who are concerned that the more entities involved in processing this data, the greater the likelihood of missing data or errors, which will lead to the degradation of the database and a loss of credibility. We're offering one amendment today to the bill to correct what we believe was a Scrivener's error. It has to do with fees related to the exchange of data among these licensed rating organizations that Senate Bill 280 compels. The concern here is that one or more parties might set prohibitive fees that would inhibit the flow of information, and at that point the regulator could step in and resolve the issue. Since there's a sense of urgency on our part as to the possible deterioration of the data and the database, the bill contains an emergency clause so that we can gain control in this changing environment as quickly as possible. In closing, I would simply add that it is our desire to preserve the consistent reporting of workers' compensation statistical data and the practice of combining the data for this state from all insurers to establish a single statewide database. With that, I thank you for your attention, and I'll respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, do you have some amendments to this bill?
I do not have them.
Are they at your site?
No.
Can you run out and make some copies?
Mr. Chair,
okay.
I may ask
yes,
a question while we're waiting
Bowman.
For the amendment. We currently have only one agency that is authorized to collect data on workmen's comp.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, that is correct. They are licensed by the state as a rating organization and statistical agent.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
And is there a... What would be the problem if there was more than one agency that was collecting that statistical data?
The concern and potential problem is that when you're collecting data that has the potential to affect the cost employers are charged and determine the benefits that workers receive, the more hands that are involved in handling, the greater the likelihood of slippage, loss, mistakes, so that you have a degradation of the database and the answers you get in terms of those charges and benefits are not as reliable or credible.
Questions. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up will be Steve Telfer, Alliance of America Insurers. Is he here? All right. Let's move to Mike Taylor, NCCI. Thank you.
Thank you. Miss this cross.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Mike Taylor. I'm the director of regional director for the National Council on Compensation Insurance. The NCCI is a not-for-profit organization that is the nation's largest single source for workers' compensation data, and as Mr. Booten said, the licensed advisory statistical organization for the state of Oregon. We support Senate Bill 280 as amended and passed by the Senate Public Affairs Committee and was passed without opposition in the Senate. The primary focus of the bill is to create a single statistical agent to collect workers' compensation data in the state of Oregon. We would support that. We, along with many stakeholders in the industry, believe that the unique nature of workers' compensation is such that the data should be collected in a uniform format and consolidated in a single source, readily available for use by regulators, legislators, insurers, and others. Without a single data collection and validation source, the chance for fragmentation increases, resulting in unreliable data, impacting Oregon rate making and the pricing of workers' compensation insurance in Oregon. The concept, as Mr. Booten said, of a single statistical agent is endorsed by most insurers, insurance trade associations, the American Academy of Actuaries, among others. We recognize and respect that not all NCCI members may share in this opinion. However, we firmly believe that this is the best option for the state of Oregon. Thank you, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have on this.
Questions? All right. Thank you. And Dave Davidson, please. All right, welcome. Can you identify yourself, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is David Davidson. I'm an executive vice president with Liberty Northwest Insurance Corporation. We're the largest writer of workers' compensation insurance in Oregon amongst private carriers. We're headquartered in Portland. We've been in operation for since 1983. I'm here representing not only Liberty Northwest, but also the Liberty Mutual Insurance Group to testify in support of Senate Bill 280, as amended and passed in the Senate. The reason for the bill, as Mr. Booten indicated, was that perhaps current law allows interpretation that PCBS does not have clear authority to establish a single statistical agent in Oregon. We believe not having that authority or not having a single statistical agent could potentially threaten the ability to accurately aggregate payroll and loss information. Rather than continue to kind of read my testimony, I have provided written testimony, and it does enumerate the many reasons why we believe a single statistical agent has a great deal of merit. We believe that having such a program does promote competition in the workers' compensation marketplace and would provide a reliable, non-fragmented base of data upon which to price the insurance.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you support the A4 dash amendments to the Senate?
Yes. Yes, and I will just kind of reinforce what maybe Mr. Putin said. We had a work group that got together and had some suggested language. It was left out in the process of developing the bill that actually got enacted. It is a protection so that as Mr. Putin said, just in case there's some real major dispute amongst the agency or the rating organizations, the insurance division can step in and settle that dispute.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you accept the motion?
Well, we're still in a public hearing. I just wanted to ask you for a moment about the statistical agent. Could you go over for me once again what the statistical agent does?
Basically, this stat agent will be required to compile data to support various functions, rate making, experience rating, various pricing of workers' compensation insurance. It's also important to try to analyze the, in effect, workers' compensation system to have a database to be able to evaluate what is generating claim costs out of the system. I think that the industry certainly generally has a strong feeling that having a single SAT agent as the vehicle to collect that data in a uniform, consistent manner is very helpful to producing good information for the regulator to evaluate things and for the legislature to be able to evaluate potential pricing changes.
Are you aware of opposition to this?
The only I've only heard one voice raised in opposition to this, and I think the issue has to do with whether or not there should be a restriction as to having only one stat agent, thinking that perhaps there would be more effective ways to gather data. I don't know if you have anybody testifying in opposition to the bill. The work group we had, there was one representative that did feel that perhaps that there was another way to approach this.
Mm-hmm. What would your response be about a single statistical agent versus more than that?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that single stat agent simplifies and ensures the integrity of the data. But also, you know, if you just think about through the process, having one collector of data, it will certainly provide for better continuity, greater assurance that the protocols are followed by the people that are reporting the data. It makes it easier for the regulator to work with one rather than a multitude of suppliers of data. So,
yeah. All right, thanks. Any further questions? All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to provide the input.
Well, I want to mention that we do have written testimony from Mr. Steve Telfer on that issue.
And it has a nice graph.
Very pretty, yes.
Nice graph.
That is a nice graph, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm glad you like it, Representative Decker.
I did.
Thank you. Anyone else wanting to testify on that? We have no one else signed up. All right, we'll close the public hearing on Central 280.
Mr. Chair.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 280.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move the A4-dash amendments into Senate Bill 280.
Representative Bowman moves the dash A4 amendments into Senate Bill 280. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, motion carries.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 280 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 280 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins? Aye.
Jack?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Deckard?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr? Sunseri? Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries. And Representative Deckert, would you carry that for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We'll close the work session on Central 280.
You can argue for just the You want to co-carry that?
I would.
Bill should ask more ease about things.
You want me to write you a poem for it?
Could you?
I would.
All right, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 586. Senate Bill 586. We'll open the work session on 586.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill or Senate Bill 586.
Representative Atkinson moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 586. Is there any discussion? Are there any? Representative Bowman.
Why?
We'll, Chair, we passed it out on Tuesday, and we have to do this to get it back.
Yeah, got to bring it back. And then we'll reveal what we're doing right after that.
As soon as you vote.
I mean, I want you to bring it back.
All right. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkins?
Aye.
Jack?
Aye.
Bowman?
Because of my trust in the chair, I will be a yes vote.
Decker?
Aye.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr? Sunseri? Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. That motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 586 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Atkinson has moved that we consider the vote by which Senate Bill 586 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Clerk, call the roll.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Still operating on faith? Yes.
Decker?
Aye.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr? Sunseri? Thompson?
Okay.
Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries. And while we're in work session, Jerry, would you come forward and tell us a bit about what we're up to here with our latest amendments? I want to mention that these amendments came as a result of some questioning that came up toward the end of the last work session on this, some concerns that the realtors had, and after talking with John Chandler, Mr. Chandler was amenable to these amendments. In fact, he's here right now, and we'll have him come forward. And let's proceed with this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I want to apologize to the committee. I was testifying in another committee, and by the time I got here, the work session had ended, and the bill had passed out of committee. I spoke with the chair and spoke with the sponsor of the bill and asked if we could bring the bill back to discuss some of the issues that Representative Censeri and others were touching on. John and I went to see the Legislative Council yesterday, had these amendments that you see before you, the Dash 1 amendments, drafted to try and answer some of the concerns the realtors had with the language in Section 6 of the bill. Our concern with Section 6 dealt with the issue about losing farm deferments in urban growth boundaries. And the concern that my membership had is that many of the areas within the urban growth boundaries may not develop for a long time or maybe not at all. And the fact that somebody is selling a piece of property, we don't want to place them in jeopardy of losing a farm assessment and thereby allowing them to continue a farm operation. Mr. Chandler discussed this with members of the work group, I believe, or task force. We were not involved in the original task force back in 96, I believe.
Yes.
And our concerns, and after talking with Mr. Chandler and others, they agreed that probably the language in Section 6 need to be tied back to Section 3. And in other words, when you're talking about losing a disqualification of farm assessments, it needs to be tied back to that language of identifying those areas that are likely to grow in the near future. And that process is identified in Section 3. So the amendments come up with two qualifications. One is that to lose that disqualification of farm assessment, first you have to be in this area that's identified in Section 3. Secondly, the urban services or the utility services have to be provided to that area. Let me tell you a little bit some of the downside scenarios that we saw in that issue. For instance, what happens if you have a property that's sitting there fully ready to develop, but yet is outside the city, and the voters will not approve annexation, so the property owner cannot annex to have his services extended to his property to develop. Should he lose his right to farm at that point and disqualify his assessment because of the fact that the urban services cannot be provided to him? So our point was is that in order to have this disqualified, you need those two things hand in hand to work together. One is that that they're in this area identified under Section 3 of the bill. They also need to be have utility services there. And that language that you see in under B of Section 6, it says the urban services are available by ordinance. The reason why we struck in the language are available by ordinance, it sets out in statute that before disqualification can occur, the utility service has to be provided. And again, that was the example that I gave you, that maybe the annexation couldn't come out, maybe the utility services aren't there, can't be there. Should a property lose the right to be able to continue as a farm until such time as the utility services are actually there? And that's our point. There are many cities in Oregon that have this predicament. The first one I was aware of, it was Corvallis, that has much of its property within the UGB and could maybe later be identified, but some of this area is not going to develop for 30 or 40 years. Mr. Chandler's other portions of the bill, which I'm not as familiar with because I wasn't in the working group, probably touches on some of those other issues, and Mr. Chandler could best address those because I didn't focus on that aspect of the bill. But this is a narrow fix. And finally, there was a language in the under Section 2 that you see in your Dash 1 amendments that said disqualification under this subsection shall not apply to a close relative, spouse, parent, stepchild, grandchildren, but it also applies to a lessee. Our concern was, what about the farmer that has been leasing this property for many years, decides that he wants to now buy the property? Should he be disqualified from continuing on as a farm assessment? I think not. I met in the hallway with LCD, who had some concerns about this language being a little bit broad. It might be, but I don't know how else to word this to make it work so that people aren't disqualified from using farm assessment legitimately. And with that, I'll close and let Mr. Chandler, or I'll have questions from the chair if he, and the members of the committee if they'd like.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Schmidt on this?
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 586.
Representative Sunseri moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 586. Any discussion? Any objections? All right. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 586 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sunseri moves Senate Bill 586 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I'm still troubled by the bill and the provisions that make it landowners able to not pay their deferred farm taxes under certain circumstances. I have a problem with that. I may, if there's another no vote in the committee, I may offer a minority report for the sake of discussion on the floor to have that issue. I know Mr. Chandler's blood is boiling inside.
It's a simmer at this point.
Okay. But I think it's an issue worthy of broader consideration. I have a problem. I think there are advantages. People who are farming land are gaining an advantage the public has given them, and they're going to be selling their property and reaping a tremendous profit when they do that. Other farmers who are also getting farm deferral who happen to be outside an urban growth boundary are unable to receive that kind of profit on their land, because they can't sell it for development prices. And I just have a problem with it. I know it's part of a work group. Apparently the governor's office supports it, but that provision just doesn't strike me as right and fair. So I'm voting no.
Thank you, Representative Beck. Any further discussion? Right, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
No.
Bowman?
No.
Deckard?
Yes.
Harper?
Yes.
Starr? Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries. Representative Sunseri, would you like to carry that bill? All right, thank you. Appreciate that. All right, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 586.
Yeah, he threatens it and never does it.
We got one left.
Let somebody else cut their work.
Now open a work session on Senate Bill 785. Or a public hearing, excuse me. We'll make that a public hearing. That's 785. Thank you. Sign up sheets come.
Standards of tool experience, quality training required for these people and allows for them to do that. Right? Move out of the house.
All right, first up to testify will be Bill Cross. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association, who requested this legislation And I have with me Stan Scotton, who works for, or with the City of Portland, who's on our board of directors, and have asked Stan to give you the background on the issue.
Very good. Thank you. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Well, my name is Stan Scotton, and I'm with the City of Portland Office of Planning and Development Review. I'm the training coordinator there. I'm also chair of the Oregon Building Officials Association Education Committee, and as such, I'm a member of the board. For the last 9 years, I've worked with the City of Portland and with the Building Codes Division on certification and training issues, and that involves inspector positions and plan examiner positions. During those 9 years, I've worked on the old Certification and Training Advisory Board and have worked on numerous task force and work groups regarding this issue. Last fall, I believe, the Building Codes Division put together another work group, including industry people, several building codes department employees, and several building officials, and we again worked on this whole certification and training issue. As a result of that last work group, we came up with an alternate path proposal. What the alternate path proposal does is allows the building official to play a bigger role in determining who gets to get certified in inspector and plan examiner issues, certifications. I'm sorry. There was some discussion after that work group that maybe statute didn't allow for that alternate path requirement, and the Oregon Building Officials Association then put together the proposal and has taken that to the legislature, and you're hearing it as it was came from the Senate side. Again, what the proposal does is really just allows the building official to play a bigger role in getting inspectors and plans examiners certified. It doesn't change any of the existing rules regarding certification and training. It doesn't do away with any of those existing paths. This would be an alternative path, a little bit of a different concept, but again, that the work group put together. One of the reasons that we're asking for this is the current system is restrictive, it's time-consuming, and it doesn't guarantee the jurisdictions necessarily quality individuals from which to hire. There's been limited applicants for the positions that jurisdictions have advertised for, and we'd like to be able to increase that pool of qualified applicants as much as we can. We feel that this proposal will help us do that. At the Senate side, we had the new building official from the City of Astoria and Warrenton appeared. Tom Phillips is his name. He came from Idaho, and he described his job search in Oregon. And again, it just pointed out the need for a larger pool of applicants, and as much as we can speed up the process of getting people through the state certification for building inspector and plans examiner. I believe, I don't know if it'll enter into testimony, but I was in contact with Perry Newell, who is an inspector for the City of St. Helens, and he indicated he had sent a fax to Representative Wilson this morning, and he would be a possible example of how this alternate path would probably help the City of St. Helens and Perry in his current certification quest. And I believe you have that fact.
Thank you. Yes, we have that, and we're introducing that into the record. Could I ask you for a moment, what ongoing problem is this bill designed to address? And if Mr. Cross would like to join in on that, he'd be welcome to do that as well.
Mr. Chair, the bill is intended to help provide a broader pool of individuals who might be able to sit for the state certification examinations. And in this state, we have fairly extensive experience and training requirements for somebody to become eligible to then sit for the examination. They must pass that examination for whatever discipline that they're looking at certification in, a plumbing inspector, a plans examiner, an electrical inspector, whatever the case may be. And the experience requirements are very extensive work experience. And sometimes it's difficult for individuals to, one, verify, complete the 4 years or 5 years or whatever the actual work experience requirement is. They may have worked in the construction industry. Their employer may no longer be in existence, so they may have a hard time documenting it. The other problem frequently that occurs is they're from out of state. They've been an inspector, and they've had what they're called multi-headed inspectors. They're able to, you know, do plumbing, mechanical and structural inspections, all three. They may have had 10 years of experience in a state, but because it's been with three different disciplines, when they have to show 4 or 5 years of actual experience doing mechanical, 4 or 5 of plumbing, and 3 or 4 of structural, they may not be eligible to get all those certifications because it was a combined experience.
And we have a shortage of inspectors now?
Mr. Chair, we do. We have positions in this, that jurisdictions have had posted over the last 3 or 4 years that oftentimes have gone 6 months, 9 months, a year before they're able to find somebody who, one, meets the certification eligibility, and two, who they, you know, would be qualified for the job. Just because you can be certified doesn't mean you're necessarily the high, you know, the first choice, because you may not have the other qualifications that a building official might be looking for, your ability to communicate with people, to problem solve, things of that nature. But we are having a hard time getting individuals who appear to be, who would be qualified to work but don't meet the certification criteria.
What kinds of problems result from this shortage of inspectors?
Mr. Chair, the obviously, if they can't fill a position, it affects customer service and the ability to do inspections on a timely basis or a plan review. And so many jurisdictions that have gone without a full complement of staff, obviously it has had impact on their customer service.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one of the concerns probably that the city of Portland has too is it affects your relationships with the various communities in your city. You know, something like this might be able to bring about more diverse people into the industry and some of those kinds of things too. I can't overstate the shortage. We've been recruiting for building inspector and plan examiner now for, I believe, plan examiner's 15 months. And although I think we're probably going to get some eligible candidates out of that, we're going to have to go back in and do third-party plan review contracts because we're not finding the quantity of good folks that we need to fill those positions.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When DCBS was told of this problem, what was their response?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, they have, they on several different occasions have put together work groups to try and resolve the issues, and in varying degrees over the years have done some things to help provide some assistance. And 2 years ago in the rulemaking process, they changed the work experience requirements for certain several of the certification categories to where it might have been 5 years in the past, it was reduced to 4, where they gave credit of experience to individuals who had what they call an International Conference of Building Officials certification in that discipline. So they have in part responded. There is a difference of philosophy between this state is probably one of the few states that has a statewide certification program. In most states, like California or Washington, the building officials simply able to hire whomever. And in those, they'll set their own criteria, and they may require national certifications or prior experience, et cetera. But, I mean, it's not a statewide requirement. We've argued that we would like to see more emphasis placed on qualitative criteria rather than the quantitative, i.e. the number of years of experience. And that's been an area where there's been some philosophic disagreements. But the state has, as I say, on several occasions put task groups together. And out of that, we have usually gotten, you know, some modest changes. I would like to correct one thing, though. In the amended version of the bill, the original bill would have allowed building officials to apply this practical evaluation as a means of, maybe if you don't meet all the experience requirements, but you've got experience, they would then have criteria that you could use to evaluate them in the field to determine whether or not they could then sit for the state examination, which is administered by BCD. The Senate did adopt an amendment at BCD's request to allow the department to adopt the rules and the procedures for applying that practical evaluation. Whether or not they want to choose at some point in time by rule to allow building officials to do the practical evaluations for certain kinds of candidates, it would be up to rule. It doesn't require them to do that anymore. But at least it would allow a procedure and a rule to be adopted to provide a practicum experience approach rather than, gee, if you don't have the 4 years, sorry, you can't even sit the exam.
Thank you.
Could I comment on that, too, Mr. Chair?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to make sure, too, that the committee understands that the Building Codes Division recognizes this and has been responsive. You know, there is a philosophical difference, but they continue to call work groups, they continue to have task forces, they continue to be open to various suggestions. So I think they're getting a little bit tired of this process also, but a lot of it has to do with the climate that they're in. I mean, you don't have to drive very far to see how much construction is going on, and there's a shortage of people. So I just want to convey that from my point of view, I think they're being trying to be a part of the solution to the problem.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate that. Thank you. Next up will be Gary Wright and John Gervais, please.
Good bill, John.
I think I do have something coming up, don't I, Mr. Majority Leader? You know, I can't tell you how much I like this bill, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Gervais, representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. I just want to take the opportunity to share some of the philosophy we have about inspection. And fortunately, because we have electrical, commercial, and industrial inspection locked in the electrical law, this doesn't touch us.
It's a good bill.
This doesn't touch us. But I think this is a dumbing down of standards and quality. And at some point, if we were to encounter many of these kinds of people, we just wouldn't buy permits.
Pardon me, you wouldn't?
Oh, wait.
No, wait.
I didn't follow your last.
We'd be tempted not to buy permits.
All right.
Because it just doesn't do it. So we consider inspection extremely important for a check on our work and the consumer protection. And we've run into a great deal of mediocrity in some of this kind of activity. The only reason we're not terribly opposed to it is that it doesn't touch us in the commercial industrial portion, and the department has the right to do it in the one or two families. Portion. They don't, plumbers don't have that same thing. But at some point, we've had so much mediocrity with small jurisdictions doing inspection, and we have not seen a shortage in terms of anything that's caused us any time frame or delays in inspection to get projects going. Good bill should pass. I think if you have the votes, I'm not going to get in the way of it.
Thank you. Mr. Wright.
Yeah, Gary Wright, representing myself and UA Local 290. I don't think it's such a good bill, but
I have other bills yet to pass.
Well, I do too, but I mean, this, I don't think it really does anything, for one thing. What I read in the bill, with the advice of the advisory boards, is still with the Director of Department of Business and Consumer Services, I think the ability we already do, as far as I know, there are field evaluations being conducted now for these folks. Again, I go along with John. We have some other legislation coming around that, you know, talks about our problems with local building departments. And sometimes, as industry people, we feel that what they're looking for is a $12 an hour inspector that's certified to work part-time. And instead of sharing their resources and sharing their inspectors and talking to their neighbors to create good quality programs, we have a tendency to lower the quality for the inspectors, lower the standards to increase the manpower pool.
Thank you. Any questions? Just a brief question for me before I go, and that is that obviously we do hear about problems with delays in inspections and how contractors and tradesmen want quick turnaround and, you know, want some action here. But you also mentioned a dumbing down of the process that would, it all seems to pull at itself. And I want to ask you about what you're really looking for in an inspector as people involved in the trades. Obviously, you want speed, you want quick turnaround, but what are you really looking for in an inspector?
Mr. Chair, if I may start off, and Gary is actually, I'm a former newspaper editor and have never had a real job. He's a tradesman and addresses this a lot better, but it was mentioned the state of California does no statewide requirements. They also have no statewide consistency in interpretation of code because of that. One thing we're looking forward to is having somebody in the field that does the inspection, that has had a hands-on experience making the installations and can do the work, knows what to look for, and will understand the code in a manner that we won't have so many interpretation problems and inconsistencies from district to district. I would say to you that the part of the problem for shortage has been that we're in the highest construction time in the history of the state, and that's now going the other way, and there are plenty of applicants for jobs in the jurisdictions I've talked to, but we want somebody with hands-on experience that can't be outsmarted by our field workers, and that's another check for the consumer and for the safety. Fortunately, we have that locked in terms of commercial industrial. That's a very important area, but I think a person's home is also very important.
So you would say that maybe construction is slowing down enough that we don't need to do anything unusual to speed things up or to make situations better, especially like in the Tri-County area?
I would say that the Tri-County area is a very unique area that has very, very difficult problems in 32 jurisdictions, and that we have a lack of coordination in the Tri-County area, which Senate Bill 512 very able covers, as you're, I'm sure, alluding to. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Senate Bill 512 and its divine inspiration. We brought in the marble tablets from where that came from, and we look forward to working with this committee very closely on that.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Anything to add to that?
Well, I would echo the same thing that John says. In the plumbing field, anyway, the plumbing and mechanical type inspectors, you're looking for a tradesperson usually that has some background as to how nuts and bolts, how things still go together. Because there's as many ways to do things as there is usually mechanics to do it. So unless you've been there and been down that road, you really don't understand it. And the construction industry, plumbing and electrical, usually aren't opposed to paying the price for inspectors. We've never been cheap about getting good quality people for those jobs. If we look right now, you say we have a shortage, but we have over 3,000 licensed plumbers in the state. We have probably 6,000 licensed electricians who could at any given moment go be an inspector or taking a test on some administrative rules. It's money. I mean, so if you follow the trail, it all goes back to money. It's the same way with the applications for inspector jobs. If you're not going to pay the money, you're not going to get qualified people. So to lower the standard to get or to build up a manpower pool, I think, is the wrong direction.
Okay, thank you.
Needs to be more efficiently get there.
All right, thanks. Any further questions? All right, thank you. Appreciate that. I'd like to have Joe Brewer while we're...
Say for the record, I didn't intend to stay there that long.
Sorry, forgiven.
I'm sorry, mediocre bill.
All right, Mr. Brewer, thank you, and would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division, and I appreciate this opportunity to provide the committee some information about what the department has done in this area and what we intend to do in the future. First I want to make it clear the department's neutral in this bill. I think it's an oversimplification to say that if there is a shortage of inspectors, it's related to the certification process. Oregon's fortunate in that it has a 25-year history of having relatively high standards for certification as an inspector. For that entire time, experience in the field, on the job site, has been a requirement in order to be certified. And I think that's critical for, if for no other reason, so that the inspector knows how to carry him or herself on the job, so that there's not a friction that starts from the very beginning because you don't understand the dynamics around the construction site. With respect to what the department's done, you've heard some of the testimony. We lowered the standards from 5 years to 4. We provided credit for ICBO certification. There's been a process put together allowing building officials to conduct cross-training on 1- and 2-family dwelling inspections so that a building official within their own jurisdiction can cross-train their people. Say an individual certified as a structural inspector can become cross-trained as a plumbing inspector in a relatively short time. We've actually had folks that we've run through the City of Portland process to become cross-certified. Multi-headed inspectors from out of state, we allow those inspectors coming into state to factor their own time. If you've got 10 years experience, as was indicated, you can factor that time so that you can become certified in 2 areas in our state. So it's not as though you automatically take 25%, you only have 2.5 years in each category. I'd like to make it clear that there was no problem with statutory authority related to the task group that was alluded to by the gentleman from Portland. The problem with task group was they were going to a place that I felt was an administrative wasteland, would have made it very difficult for us to administer the program. Their proposal would have created an alternate path, allowing an individual that had 50% of the qualifications to become certified conditionally. I forget the exact term, but they would have been certified conditionally to work in that jurisdiction. And we've got a very complex building codes administration system already. I felt as though that was problematic, not only because you're going from 4 years experience to 2, but because now you have to keep track of where that inspector's working and in which jurisdiction he's doing inspections. So my proposal was to work with the task group and try and find some middle ground. The legislation that you see before you was submitted before that process could be completed. Once the legislation was submitted, I terminated the task group pending the outcome of the legislation. The legislation, as I read it, would require the department to put together a process for evaluating folks in the field, and we do that already, and we're more than willing to do that. It does not create an alternate path for certification, as I read it. So I just wanted to try and clarify that for the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many women and people of color are building inspectors in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, I don't have that information at hand, but I'd be happy to get it back to you just as soon as I can.
I'd appreciate it.
Sure.
You don't want to try a guess?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, the numbers are very small. Traditionally, we've had difficulty finding candidates for those positions, and I think certainly more needs to be done, and if we can open the certification process up so that more candidates from those groups come to the process, it would be a good thing.
Further questions? Let me ask you on line 12 here, when we talk about the standard shall include provisions for determining a practical experience equivalent. What are we reading there? What does that say in your mind?
Practical equivalence experience would be someone who has had experience inspecting, perhaps in this state or in another state, and creating some criteria to accept that. In many respects, I believe that process is already in place, and certainly this would drive us to revisit that and to consider changes in that area.
Any further questions? Is this, before we go, is this going to, I guess I'm a little confused here. I've been believing all along that we had a problem, and I guess I'm thinking in respect to the Tri-County area specifically, but I've been understanding that we've been having some problems statewide with getting some quick turnarounds on some things associated with the trades. And I feel like I'm getting mixed messages today that that may not be a problem. And so what would your answer be to that?
Mr. Chairman, there are 130 jurisdictions in the state. In some of those jurisdictions, there are problems in getting a consistent, timely response. Mm-hmm. In many other jurisdictions, the building department's there do a fine job. So I think it's jurisdiction specific, and I think it's specific to some inspector categories, for instance. I think part of the problem with recruiting and retention, for instance, may be the quality of work life, quality of living in that area, rate of pay. The building codes division, we pay among the lowest in the state. We don't have a problem recruiting and retaining qualified people. We did in the past when we were paying even less. So there are lots of issues. It's a very complex matter. I think to generalize that there are problems across the state would be an overstatement. I agree that there are certainly unique challenges in the metro area. I think there are unique challenges in Eastern Oregon. Met in Pendleton last week with a group over there that was very interested in trying to address some of the problems that are unique to Eastern Oregon.
If this bill were to become law and it were enacted the way the proponents hope that it would be, how could this be of service then to those specific jurisdictions that may be short or specific areas of geography like Eastern Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, as I read the bill, it would require the division to put together some process for field evaluating an inspector's capabilities. And I would envision that addressing individuals who perhaps could not demonstrate, document all of their experience at some threshold. Would it be half of the experience? I think we have to go through the administrative rules process to determine what that would be. I was uncomfortable with going there as it was being recommended by the task group. So there would be some level at which an individual would qualify for this field evaluation. And I think that requires an administrative rule process to determine what the industry, what the other stakeholders feel is appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. Next up will be Jane Cummins, League of Oregon Cities, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My written testimony is very brief, and basically it is that the League of Oregon Cities supports Senate Bill 785. If we believe that it does assist local jurisdictions in filling positions for plans examiners and inspectors, city managers continue to tell us that they are restricted in the limited pool of applicants, and they would like to be able to increase that pool to meet the needs of their communities. We hear this across the state, and we think that Senate Bill 85 is one of the answers. Let me make a few comments about some of the previous testimony. We do not feel that this is in any way a dumbing down. We feel that this is some flexibility that will not threaten safety, and safety is our number one priority as well. As I mentioned, managers have said to me over the last several years, whether it's in the Tri-County area or whether it's in the east or on the coast, that they have a problem in recruitment, that the pool that they get is not very large. Stan Scotton referred to Mr. Phillips. I believe he testified that in the cities that he applied, there were pools of two or three, and that was it. That doesn't seem like a very large pool from which to draw. But I think that is an example of what is common in Oregon communities. And it's not a question of cities not paying enough. It's not a question of cities not sharing. We've had city managers say that they are offering pay levels that surpass many of the other positions in the city to attract people in the building department. We have examples of cities where they are sharing inspectors. A good example would be out in Eastern Oregon in Boardman, where they finally, with some other jurisdictions, attracted a plumbing inspector, a former plumber, and he is the building official for several jurisdictions, and he does the plumbing inspections, I understand, for the city of Pendleton. So there are these examples going on. We do it to the extent that we are able, but we still are faced with a shortage. And again, we would ask that you support 785 as one way to address the problem.
The intent of this bill is going to hinge a lot on rulemaking and how it goes together. And do you have any concerns about if this bill is enacted that it wind up not accomplishing what you really hope that it does?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that we will be very interested in being a part of that rulemaking and to consider the options and alternatives that brought forth and try to make it a positive. I like to believe that that would happen from what the administrator spoke to.
All right. Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 785, and I will have that back on the schedule for work session on Tuesday, next Tuesday. Okay. It's in here. Okay. That clears the schedule.
Did we do this 287 thing?
We did.
Yeah, we did. We'll have a busy Tuesday and Thursday of next week for the business.
You get a minority report on it.